Welcome back to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city, with Robert Louis Abrahamson inviting you to attend. I've called this week's show the Athena Connection. We often take myths as our themes on Evening Under Lamplight, and it's time to try this again, especially since Athena has always been a mythological deity that means a lot to me, and also to Susan N. Davis. And there are a few things about her myth that I think will be helpful for all of us to think about. But before we go further, let's introduce our theme with a bit of Greek dance music from a group called Athena. I've been able to find out almost nothing about them, but my knowledge of classical Greek, slight though it is, enables me to translate the titles of at least some of their songs. Here's a track called Agape Kai Aletheia, which means love and truth. Perhaps you know the word agape from the New Testament, and the word aletheia is related to Lethe, the river of forgetfulness. A means not, and so the word literally means not Lethe, not forgetfulness. It embodies a myth in itself. In Plato's scheme of things, our soul knows all truths, but when we are born, incarnated into our bodies, limited to only the knowledge coming through our senses, we forget the truths deep in our soul. Our object in life, therefore, is to negate this forgetfulness. In other words, try to remember the eternal truths found in our soul. Truth, then, becomes a matter of unforgetting. I didn't think I'd be getting so heavy at the start of the show. But don't worry. Most of the show this evening, Under Lamplight, will involve two or three stories we'll tell together. And we always love stories. And for now, what could be lighter or more light-spirited than this Greek dance, Agape Kai Aletheia, Love and Truth, by the band Athena? Okay, that's enough. You know dance music, it just goes round and round. That's fine if you're dancing to it, but a wee bit tiresome when you're just attending to it. Agape Kai Aletheia, Love and Truth, by the Greek band Athena. Now, what made me turn to Athena this week? I was listening, as I often do, to the Heart Wisdom podcast with Jack Kornfield, whom I've spoken about before here, I believe. Jack Kornfield is always engaging, wise, witty, and gentle. On this podcast, Jack was speaking with Duncan Trussell, a kind of excited straight man, eager, perceptive, and humble. Duncan, a stand-up comedian when he's not a straight man, and the host of a popular podcast called the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast, was speaking to Jack about his embarrassment when people come up to him and thank him and praise him as such an effective teacher of, I suppose, spiritual or, let's say, alternative insights. "You're my guru," they say. Well, he wants to deny this. He can't take any credit for this. He's not speaking about his ideas, after all, but ideas taken from Ram Dass, Jack Kornfield, and others. So, he asks Jack, what should he do in such situations? How can he protect his ego from getting inflated from this praise? How can he retain some integrity? Jack told him not to run from this praise. You're their mentor, he said. And he explained that mentor was this Greek man who actually knew how to empower others, and that's part of the role, and you step up to it. That's not a bad reply. When people thank us or praise us for something we feel we can't take credit for, let us think a minute before refusing to take credit. If the ideas weren't ours to begin with, well, but surely we have been the vehicle by which these ideas came to that person, and somehow we have conveyed these ideas in such a way that they got through to someone else. There's a lot of credit due to this. This is what being a mentor is, according to Jack Kornfield. But here, Jack was treading on ground that I also spend time on. Mentor was not really a Greek man, but a character in the Odyssey, which makes him a mythic figure. Mentor was an old man whom Odysseus put in charge of his household, his most personal attachments, before he left for the Trojan War. Odysseus knew how to choose his people, and this role he gave to Mentor turns the character into a kind of mythic guardian or protector. In particular, Mentor is looking after Odysseus's son Telemachus, a wee baby when he left for the war, but now, when we meet Telemachus at the beginning of the Odyssey, he is 20 years old. He's grown up with only stories about his wonderful, legendary father, but has had to face the daily encounters with dozens of local aristocratic young men hanging around the palace trying to marry Telemachus' mother, Penelope, on the assumption that Odysseus must be long dead. These guys are parasites, hanging out in Odysseus' house, feasting on his food, drinking his wine, sleeping with his servants. Not the kind of role models for a young hero, you'll agree. But Mentor is looking out for him, and presumably has been serving as the role model for the growing boy, and presumably has been telling the boy all about his father Odysseus, who must be the ultimate role model. But Telemachus' challenge now, in order to finish his education and build him into the son Odysseus will be proud of, his challenge is to stand up to these awful suitors and take a stand on his own. Athena, the goddess who has particular care over Odysseus and his family, comes disguised to advise Telemachus to go off on a journey to his father's old friends to see if anyone has any news of the long-lost king of Ithaca. And to help him on the journey, Athena takes the form of Mentor and goes around the town gathering the right sort of people to man the ship that will take Telemachus on his journey. Athena, continuing in her disguise as Mentor, comes with them and guides Telemachus in his first encounter with an important person outside his homeland. Nestor, the old king who had been one of the leaders with Odysseus at the Trojan War. There's Telemachus, inexperienced, unsure of himself, hesitant to go speak to old Nestor. But Mentor Athena reassures him. Some of the words you'll find within yourself, she tells him. The rest, some power will inspire you to say. Can you see how this is what we call mentoring? Mentor, inspired by Athena, gives the young man encouragement and basically tells him to have confidence in his own abilities. Or not quite, actually. Only some of the words will be his own initiative. The rest will come through inspiration. Inspiration from without, from Athena, speaking through Mentor. So Mentor's task is simply to open himself to being an instrument for inspiration to come through to the person in his charge. You can see how this connects to Duncan Trussell's question. When he takes on the role of mentor to someone, he is just being the channel through which some higher source of inspiration can pass through to that other person. So don't worry, Duncan. No need to get a swelled head. As a mentor, you're just nothing, an empty passageway. But what could be more honorable than such emptiness in the service of inspiration? After all, you may be anyone in the world, but you're going to have to serve somebody.
You may be an ambassador to England or France. You may like to gamble. You might like to dance. You may be the heavyweight champion of the world. You may be a socialite with a long string of pearls, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, indeed, you're gonna have to serve somebody. Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Maybe a rock and roll addict dancing on the stage. Money, drugs at your command, women in a cage. You may be a businessman or some high degree thief. They may call you doctor or they may call you chief, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are, you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil or serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
It may be a state trooper. It may be a young Turk. Maybe the head of some bigger TV network. You may be rich or poor. You may be blind or lame. Maybe living in another country under another name. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you are. You're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Maybe you're a construction worker working on a home. Might be living in a mansion. You might live in a dome. You may own guns. And you may even own tanks. You may be somebody's landlord. You may even own banks. But you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
You're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody. Preacher, spiritual pride. Maybe a city councilman taking bribes on the side. Maybe working in a barber shop, you may know how to cut hair. And maybe somebody's mistress, maybe somebody's heir. But you're gonna have to serve somebody. Yes, you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Might like to wear cotton, might like to wear silk, might like to drink whiskey, might like to drink milk, might like to eat caviar, you might like to eat bread. Maybe sleeping on the floor, sleeping in a king-size bed, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve
yes, indeed,
somebody.
You're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Somebody.
You may call me Terry, or you may call me Timmy. You may call me Bobby, or you may call me Zimmy. You may call me RJ, you may call me Ray. You may call me anything, no matter what you say. You're still gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Yes, you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Serve
but you're gonna have to serve somebody.
Yes, you never know. Everyone you come across is serving somebody. It may be the devil or it may be the Lord. It may even be Athena, whom you are serving by opening yourself to her inspiration, to the person you are mentoring. And that's what we've been following, the way Mentor serves Athena as he mentors Telemachus. Oh yes, and by the way, that was Bob Dylan, Gotta Serve Somebody. And by the way, does Telemachus know that he is not really hearing Mentor, but he's hearing Athena speaking through Mentor? This isn't clear. Odysseus, the experienced one, can tell right away when Athena is speaking to him, but I don't know about Telemachus. But just to be sure he doesn't miss it, when Athena leaves, she wings away in an eagle's form and flight. Aho! So it was something divine after all. No mistaking this clue. And what does this suggest? Does it tell us that for most of us inexperienced people, we recognize our moments of inspiration only after the moment has passed, only when looking back? Who was that masked man, as people used to ask, when the Lone Ranger rode off? Or as the two men on the road to Emmaus experienced it, it was just some stranger they were talking to and who expounded all the mysteries surrounding Jesus' death, until at dinner he broke the bread and gave it to them. And their eyes were opened, and they knew him, and he vanished out of their sight. Only afterwards did they realize they were in the presence of divinity, giving us that wonderful line, "Did not our heart burn within us while he talked with us by the way?" Yes, I suppose our hearts always burn within us when we are inspired. But we often don't notice this until later when we look back on the experience. We have to keep alert and open to all outside influences, as Telemachus and Duncan Trussell is humble enough to do, because we never know when we might be entertaining deities or angels unawares.
Some people say that life is just a given thing, but you and I both know by whom it's lent, and that it's right here in the dirt where we've both been loved and learned. That love himself has come to pitch his tent. Sometimes we're in the fields of holy roses, other times we're rolling in the tares, breaking bread, sharing wine. Did I feel your hand touch mine, or did we both touch angels down by the oaks of memory? Joseph dreams beside an empty barn, and there's a woman by the well. She's got dreams no man can tell, though a broken man might keep her safe from harm. Somebody else inside my fiery furnace, Jacob is gazing up those endless stairs. We are all wounded on the road, but we share each other's load, and we make make each other angels unawares. Everybody backs into the future. Everyone is just feeling for it blind. And sometimes we get lost, all the threads of our lives get crossed. But I'm sure glad yours got tangled up with mine. Day is gone and I know I should be going. There's barely light enough to say our prayers. Harbor, give me leave the while for to turn and to see you smile. And leave to love like angels unawares. Leave to love like angels unawares.
That was Cambridge's own Malcolm Gait with Angels Unawares. The situation of Telemachus, unaware until the last minute that he's been in the presence of the divine Athena. Everybody backs into the future. But wait a minute, let's ask again, who is that masked man? Or rather, who is Athena? What does she stand for in Greek mythology? She's always depicted fully armed, with a shield, a helmet, and a spear. She's a war goddess, but not like Ares, who's the god of angry, aggressive, even berserk warfare, mindless violence. Athena is the goddess of a much more controlled kind of warfare, the goddess of strategy and tactics. She's the one who suggested the idea of the Trojan horse to Odysseus. She's the one who directed Odysseus's operations when he returned to Ithaca and had to work out how, greatly outnumbered, he could defeat the horde of suitors who took over his house and were threatening his wife. And in the incident with Telemachus we're speaking about, she shows us tactics, or perhaps just tact, in a peacetime encounter. Telemachus, a young unknown stranger, is approaching Nestor, the king around these parts. What tactic does he use to achieve his end? Remember, Athena had said he would find some of the right words within himself, and the rest some power will inspire you to say. She's that power, and Telemachus says just the right thing to win over Nestor so that he gives the young man a hero's welcome. He doesn't ask Nestor the question he wants to find out, does Nestor know if Odysseus is still alive? He asks him instead if he can tell Telemachus how Odysseus died. Because after all, Odysseus fought with you in all those battles back before the walls of Troy 10 years ago and more. Can you see why this is such a clever tactic? The aim is to soften this foreign king, this old veteran of many wars. Suppose he had asked if Nestor knows whether Odysseus has died, and suppose Odysseus has died. Then Telemachus has put the old king in the painful position of having to break him the news, and no one appreciates being put into a painful position. But there's another angle here, too. By reminding Nestor of his old companion in the old campaigns, he gives a veteran what a veteran loves best, the chance to tell old war stories. No better way to soften this guy up. And Nestor gets started, and the man can talk. He goes on and on, but actually never really gives Telemachus any specific news. Yet it turns out that this is not the point, after all, as Athena and perhaps Nestor had planned it all along. The aim was to send Telemachus out into the world to take his place as a young hero, which in time of war means winning glory through one-on-one combat with heroes on the other side, but during peacetime, like now in the story, you get your glory by being royally welcomed as a guest of high standing and being given lots of expensive gifts in parting, And this is exactly what Nestor does for Telemachus. What better way to boost up this young man's confidence than to have him treated as a hero? This was Athena's strategy. But there's more to Athena than this. Remember her armor. Athena is often spoken of as the deity of defensive battle, protecting the city or the home against attack. And that takes us closer to an older aspect of Athena as a kind of domestic deity, the goddess of that essential domestic activity of weaving. In the days before you could walk into a shop and buy your clothes off the rack, or even go to a tailor and have a suit tailor-made for you, all your clothes were homemade, woven in the house. Next to providing food, providing clothing was the most important activity in the house. And this was Athena's realm. In the Odyssey, sitting at the loom is one of the privileges of the highest-born women, and it was not just a necessary craft, but an art form. We'll see more about this later on this evening. We want to consider the metaphoric or symbolic sense of weaving a little further. But let's stop for a few minutes for a song about the weavers. Not necessarily the women, but the men too, back in the pre-industrial days when weaving was a cottage industry and clothes were not made in factories. Weavers were proud of their job, as this Scottish song shows. There are people who are independent of other people's work. Women need no barbers, the song says, and dykers, folk who mend walls, need no clerk. But there's no one who doesn't need the weavers. They canny want the work of the weavers. Even those in South America, them we never saw, even they need the work of the weavers. If it wasn't for the weavers, what would they do? They wouldna hae claith made oor woo. They wouldna hae a coat neither black nor blue, gin it wasna for the work of the weavers. That is, they would not have cloth made out of our wool, oota oor woo, if it wasn't for the work of the weavers, ken. The song was written by David Shaw in the early part of the 19th century, just as he saw the world of domestic hand looms disappearing. This is a version sung by Alex Campbell.
We're all met together here to sit and to crack, with your glasses in our hands and our work upon our backs. There's nae a trade among them all, neither men nor mack. If it was any for the work of the weavers, if it was any for the weavers, what would they do? They wouldna hae claes made of oor woo. They wouldna hae a coat neither black nor blue, gin it wasna for the work o' the weavers. The hireman chills, they mock us, and they crack all about us. They say we're onthin faced and dinna mend our boots. But yet for all their mockery, they canna dae wi'oot us, nor they canna want the work o' the weavers. Gin it wasna for the weavers, what would they do? They wouldna hae claes made of oor woo. They wouldna hae a coat neither black nor blue, gin it wasna for the work o' the weavers. There's our richts and our slaters and our glaziers and a', our doctors and our ministers and them that live below, and our friends in South America, though them we never saw. But we ken they were the work o' the weavers, gin it wasna for the weavers, what would they do? They wouldna hae claes made of oor woo. They wouldna hae a coat neither black nor blue, gin it wasna for the work o' the weavers. There's our sailors and our soldiers, we ken they're all bald, but if they had any clothes to wear, they couldna fecht for cold. The high and low, the rich and poor, all body young and old, they wouldna want the work o' the weavers. If it wasna for the weavers, what would they do? They wouldn't hae clothes made of oor woo. They wouldn't hae a coat neither black nor blue, and it wasn't for the work o' the weavers. There's folks that's independent o' other tradesmen's work. The women need nae barber and the dikers need nae clerk. But nane of them can dae without a coatie or a sack, nor they canny want the work o' the weavers. Gin it wasnae for the weavers, what would they do? They wouldnae hae claes made of oor woo. They wouldnae hae a coat neither black nor blue. Gin it wasnae for the work o' the weavers. The weaving is a trade, boy, that never can fail, as long as folks need clothes to keep one another hale. So light as I be merry, our pint to get ale, and drink to the health o' the weavers. If it wasn't for the weavers, what would they do? We wouldn't hae clothes made o' oor woo. We wouldn't hae a coat neither black nor blue, gin it wasn't for the work o' the weavers.
Maybe you thought you were back with Kipper the Cat and scratchy old records. This record you've just heard is, I think, but not quite 50 years old, Vaya's Muir. And you might recall Billy Connolly's theme song, If It Wasn't for the Wellies. But let's not go into that now. We have to continue with Athena and the myth of the importance of weaving here on Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. All right, let's put it this way. If the Greeks perceived the same goddess as representing weaving and tactics, they must have seen some connection between the two, and if we probe this further, we may well learn something about the truths of our world. That's the reason we pay attention to myths, after all. It's more than just an academic game. What is a tactical understanding of a situation? We see the people and the circumstances around us, and we want to act in the best way to achieve our goals in this situation. We can't just push our own goals through. Well, we can if we have the strength, but that's just a power play and does not add to the betterment of the world. No, the best way is to weave our plans and desires into the situation, weave them into the pattern created by the plans and desires of everyone else. This is not only tactical, but tactful. And being respectful of others ensures that they are less likely to stand in our way and may actually help us achieve our plans and goals. And furthermore, if we do this well, we then take our place in the larger patterns of life, a dance of weaving in and out with others, which is joyful in itself. Or it's a tapestry of many different colors of threads, turning our lives and the lives of all those around us into a work of beauty. And when we work this way, the Greeks tell us, we are being inspired by Athena, goddess of weaving and tact. But that's all very easy to say. The real question is, how do we weave ourselves into the web around us? We take part in the weaving, or we take a part in the weaving. We play a part, or we might even say we go in disguise. This is what we see most often happening in the Athena stories. We've seen the way she disguised herself as Mentor. Throughout the Odyssey, she takes on several different forms. She seldom speaks directly to her favorites, but like Emily Dickinson, she tells all the truth but tells it slant. And those whom she favors, especially Odysseus, also take on disguises. Whenever Odysseus comes into a new situation, he takes on a fictional role, the son of a rich merchant who had been wrecked in a storm or captured by pirates or whatever. In fact, when at last he reveals his true identity and then tells the story of his wanderings, the man-eating Laestrygonians, Scylla and Charybdis, the Cyclops, 8 years with the passionate nymph Calypso, 1 year with the gorgeous witch Circe, Well, do we actually believe him? They're great stories, but we've seen Odysseus make up stories all the time. Why should he suddenly start telling true stories? Does this mean that Athena is the goddess of liars? No, not really. Hermes is the god of liars, the trickster god, though the two deities are related in more ways than at first appears. Hermes seems to lie almost just for the fun of it. He likes to play with the truth, since by playing with the truth, he can often uncover a deeper truth lurking in the shadows. But Athena and her devotees lie as a matter of tact. It's the way they enable their thread to weave into the pattern of everyone else. In more modern days, this is called social graces. You have dinner at someone's house and you don't tell that person that the meal was undercooked, at least not if your strategy is to get invited back again. You play the part of the gracious guest, and even if that means you're taking on a fictional role, of course you do it. When you're playing cards and get three aces in your hand, you don't start smiling. You put on a poker face and play dumb. Athena inspires you to hide your true self so you can weave the hand you're holding into the pattern of the game as it's going at the moment. But more important, perhaps, how well are you aware that your role-playing is part of Athena's inspiration? All your talents in presenting yourself are gifts bestowed by Athena. Odysseus is always grateful to Athena for the help he sees her giving him, and Telemachus also learns to be grateful. Maybe Mentor also is grateful, though we never get close enough to him to find out. Because, and here's the dire warning, because if you are not grateful, then you become Arachne, and you know what happened to her, don't you? I think we've attended to the story of Arachne before on Evening Under Lamplight, but it won't hurt to come back to it again in the context of Athena's gifts. Arachne was the greatest weaver on earth, celebrated for her canny fingerwork on the loom, for her flying fingers, which gives us an excuse for a short pause to hear Flying Fingers, the old Supercell's theme song, my favorite. Flying Fingers, obviously inspired by Athena. But now for the story of Arachne and her threads. Arachne grew up in a relatively poor household, simple artisans, living obscurely, just making it in life. But Arachne discovered that she had an exceptional talent for weaving, and she nurtured this talent as she grew up. Soon she developed a reputation for her beautiful tapestries. She no longer lived in obscurity, but was famous throughout the land. People would come from all over to see her magic fingers flying across the loom, creating beautiful works of art. People would praise the work, and Arachne would swell with pride and admit that she was indeed pretty wonderful. No acknowledgement that her talent was inspired by Athena, notice. No sense that her talent was a gift, separate from her true self. Arachne identified herself with her talents, a mistake many of us make. Athena heard about this great weaver and came to her in disguise, of course. This is Athena, remember. Disguised as an old woman. You would do well to be thankful to Athena for this great gift, she said. gift, replied Arachne. This is no gift. There's no goddess to thank. It's all my own talents and abilities that got me where I am. I worked hard for this, and I give no one else credit but me. She may have had the gift of weaving from Athena, but you see, she had no tact. Don't be so hasty, said the old woman. Athena is a gracious goddess. Say you're sorry, and even now she will forgive you, and endow you with even greater abilities. Athena, scoffed Arachne. What do I care for her? Let her come here herself, and I'll show her who's the better weaver. At that, off comes Athena's disguise, and she rises up in her full goddess nobility. But even then Arachne is not abashed. The two agree to have a standoff contest, and they get their servant girls to bring lots of thread. They set up their looms side by side, they roll up their sleeves to free their arms, and the competition begins. Athena produces a marvelous tapestry, showing the power of the gods and the good things they give to human beings. Arachne also produces a marvelous tapestry, equal in skill and beauty to Athena's. Only, not having tact, as you recall, her design depicted all the times the gods got drunk, or played the fool, or came down to rape human beings, or otherwise abuse them. Tactless, especially when you know that one of those deities is right next to you. But Arachne was full of herself and thought her abilities could protect her. Athena was incensed and rose up in anger, knocking over Arachne's loom and ripping up her tapestry. As we have seen, Arachne had been merging her own identity with the work she did, and having her beautiful work destroyed was tantamount to having her identity destroyed. She ran off to the back room, got some strong rope, and hanged herself. Athena saw her and took pity. After all, this woman had done excellent work. Athena had invested a lot in this woman's talents. It would be a shame to waste the talents. So she nodded her head, or winked, or wrinkled her nose, or whatever she did, and this woman, hanging from the rope, began to shrink. Her arms and legs each split into two and grew long and thin, so that there were 8 thread-like legs, and her head shrunk to a tiny ball while her body swelled up. The rope turned into thin, silvery, sticky stuff, and Arachne began once again to weave, only this time she was weaving not tapestry, but spider's webs. She had become a spider. Of course, we knew that would happen all along, since Arachne is the Greek word for spider. Why did she become a spider? The easy answer is that she was a fine weaver, and a spider, too, is a fine weaver of intricate webs. She was hanging by a rope, and a spider hangs by a thread of gossamer. But there's more to it. There always is, with Greek metamorphoses. What characterizes a spider? The spider sits in the middle of the web, waiting for someone to come along and get stuck in the web, and then the spider feeds on that insect. And isn't this what Arachne had been doing? She wove her beautiful webs, which attracted admirers from far and wide, who came to see her and fed her ego. She lived off her admirers just like a spider. See how wise these myths can be, how enlightening. When we, too, just use our talents to attract praise and feed our egos, we are like Arachne, ungrateful for the inspiration that gives us the abilities, and just using others, not enjoying them. We confuse our ego identity with our true identity. We are then untrue to those things we owe loyalty towards, so we prey on others, like a spider luring the fly into the web. You know that story?
looking, wondering what I do when I'm through tonight. Smoking, moping, maybe just hoping some little girl will pass on by. Don't wanna be alone, but I love my girl at home. I remember what she said. Thinking about the rinsed out blonde on my left, and then I said hi like a spider to a fly, remembering what my little girl said.
It's always amazing how relaxed the Rolling Stones are about expressing their baser emotions. Even though this musician knows his girl back home has claims on him, he can't help sitting, drinking, superficially thinking about the rinsed-out blonde on his left. He knows his attractions and can't resist luring into his web that rinsed-out blonde fly. Common, flirty, she looked about 30. A machine operator who liked the way he held the microphone. Holding the mic like that is typical spider behavior, isn't it? What can you do next but say, my, my, like a spider to a fly, jump right ahead in my web. And so Duncan Trussell played the part of mentor in humility and good faith. Just be open and listen to that wise, canny voice of Athena asking to speak through you. Listening ties us right into the Whitman passage this week. After talking about himself for several chants, Walt Whitman, an American, one of the roughs, a cosmos, he now stops and listens. I think I will do nothing for a long time but listen, and accrue what I hear into myself, and let sounds contribute toward me. This is different from the spider who just sits there luring others in. Whitman goes out of himself to get closer to everything else around him, not so he can feed off them, but so he can accrue what I hear into myself. He doesn't stop the others from doing what they're doing. He just attends to them, and in that attending, he grows. The sounds contribute towards him. And then comes another one of Whitman's catalogues. Here a long, exuberant list of the people and things he is listening to. I hear the bravuras of birds, the bustle of growing wheat, the gossip of flames, clack of sticks cooking my meals. these aren't things we often hear these days. Even in the countryside, there are so many fewer birds now than there used to be. How many of us get so close to the wheat that we can hear it rustling as the breeze blows over it? The gossip of flames? How many of us get anywhere near an open fire? Certainly few of us associate the clack of sticks with cooking meals. So what would be our equivalent? Traffic noises, yes, why not? How often do you listen to the noise of traffic? If we can't hear the breeze over the wheat fields, maybe we can at least hear the sound of a loose sheet of newspaper as it is blown down the street. You ever pay attention to the sound of the heating system or air conditioning coming on? Or the sound of the computer? Never still when we are working at it. Are you boiling water as part of preparation for dinner? Do you listen to the sound of the boiling? Don't worry. Whitman now moves from the countryside to the city. I hear the sound of the human voice, a sound I love. I hear all sounds as they are tuned to their uses, sounds of the city and sounds out of the city, sounds of the day and night, talkative young ones to those that like them, the recitative of fish peddlers and fruit peddlers, the loud laugh of work people at their meals, the angry bass of disjointed friendship, the faint tones of the sick, the judge, with his hands tight to the desk, his shaky lips pronouncing a death sentence, the heave-ho of stevedores unlading ships by the wharves, the refrain of the anchor lifters, the ring of alarm bells, the cry of fire, the whirr of swift-streaking engines and hose carts with premonitory tinkles and colored lights, the steam whistle, the solid roll of the train of approaching cars, the slow march played at night at the head of the association, they go to guard some corpse. The flag tops are draped with black muslin. And now a different kind of sound, music. I hear the violoncello, or man's heart's complaint, and hear the keyed cornet, or else the echo of sunset. I hear the chorus. It is a grand opera. This indeed is music. A tenor large and fresh as the creation fills me. The orbic flex of his mouth is pouring and filling me full. And now the music stirs him into an orgasm of pleasure and an almost hallucinogenic trip to the very essence of his being. I hear the trained soprano. She convulses me like the climax of my love grip. The orchestra whirls me wider than Uranus flies. It wrenches unnameable ardors from my breast. It throbs me to gulps of the farthest down horror. It sails me. I dab with bare feet. They are licked by the indolent waves. I am exposed, cut by bitter and poisoned hail, steeped amid honeyed morphine, my windpipe squeezed in the flakes of death. Let up again to feel the puzzle of puzzles, and that we call being.
Yeah!
there, perhaps, is the trained soprano who convulses Whitman into an orgasmic psychedelic hallucination, the Queen of the Night's famous aria from Mozart's Magic Flute, Der Hölle Rache kocht in meinem Herzen, The Vengeance of Hell Boils in My Heart, sung by Ima Berger with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. The Queen of the Night has just put a knife into the hands of her daughter Pamina and ordered her to kill Sarastro, or you're no daughter of mine. And with that, now we've come to the end of our evening together under lamplight, and so let me thank you for attending. You're my inspiration, after all. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson. This has been Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, and you have been, well, attentive, I hope. And here's a bit of Mozart again, played by the Athena Quartet. Thank you.
Thank you.